Hello and welcome. What is a hero? Post 9/11, it seems that nearly everyone is. Prior to 9/11, there could not have been nearly as many as there appears to be today, compliments of our friends at the mainstream media. My next guest is perhaps the quintessential pre-9/11 hero, as it was he who, through repeated attempts, tried to bring the results of an intelligence-gathering operation, codenamed Able Danger, to the head of the 9/11 Commission, to show that the alleged terrorists were in the crosshairs of the military over a year before September 11th. For a variety of reasons, this patriot's message never made it to the people in charge, and he was rewarded with a suspended security clearance. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer only ever wanted to be an intelligence operative. Enlisting in 1980, he conducted real-life Mission Impossible-type operations as a U.S. Army officer across the globe in service of his country. Always aware of who it was that he was protecting, not his career or his turf, but the mostly nameless and faceless American public. Joining me on the line is Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, the author of the book Operation Darkheart, Spycraft and Special Ops on the Front Lines of Afghanistan and the Path to Victory. Lieutenant Colonel, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, David. I appreciate it.
Lieutenant Colonel, is it okay if I call you Anthony or Tony?
I go by Tony, so.
Thank you, Tony. Before I get into this book a little bit, I read in the news a little while back something about the Defense Intelligence Agency buying up copies of this book and burning them. Is that right?
Well, they were quick to defend themselves on the burning allegation. They pointed out, and I think you'll find, David, this is grandly ironic, the very day that they announced, I believe it was the 24th of September, they announced that they bought 9,700 copies, I believe it was, somewhere in there, to the tune of $47,000 taxpayer money, and they destroyed all of these copies. And they announced it, surprisingly enough, on the very day the second edition came out, on the 24th of September. So it created a lot of interest, and as you specified there, basically DOD was not clear on how they destroyed them. So the whole image of book burning and the Nazis came to the forefront of the public's imagination. And over that weekend, that was a Friday, over that weekend of the 25th and 26th, there was huge press monitoring and talking about this book burning. And DOD was very quick on Monday, after they did this faux pas on Friday, to point out, no, we merely pulped it. We really didn't burn it. Which obviously, you know, it's one of those things, maybe just keeping quiet might have been a better course of action, because obviously the next thing that happened was that the whole thing was spun up again that entire week. So they have not done well in talking about the issue of why they did it. People have been more focused on the fact that they destroyed, you know, nearly 10,000 books. And it's been, I got to be honest with you, David, it's been a huge publicity bonanza for me in the book by the fact that this past Sunday, it was actually number 7 on the printed New York Times bestseller list. Right under Bill O'Reilly's book, by the way.
Did you send them a thank you card?
I've toyed with the idea of actually showing up at the director of DIA's office at the Pentagon and dropping off some roses, but I don't know. I think that would probably cause more trouble than it's worth.
I was kidding. You know what? I got that line right out of your book, and I was very moved by your book.
Well, thank you.
For a variety of reasons, and I want to ask first, how's your knee?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Army, God bless them, actually spent 6 months in 2006 helping rebuild it. I was amazed because I was actually popping one of the old drugs. It's now banned. And I want to say Ambien, but I know it's not correct. It was the one of those painkillers.
I think you mentioned in the book it was like Vioxx or something.
Vioxx. Thank you. And it was Vioxx. And I went in to get a prescription refilled, and they said, you're too young to be popping this. And the Army, God bless them, put me into therapy and actually helped rebuild the cartilage, which had been damaged. And frankly, it's better than ever. Thank you for asking, but the Army actually, you know, help repair it. It's in good shape now.
Good. And the other question I had before we talk about the book is, how are Alexander and Ryan?
Well,
your two sons.
Yes. Alexander is, God bless him, he's now about to be an Eagle Scout. He's working on his final things. And obviously, I was no Eagle Scout growing up. And I've made several comments to that effect, not even a Boy Scout. And he's doing very well. I'm very proud of him. He's doing well in high school. And then Ryan just turned the healthy age of 4 years old last week. So he's doing very well as well. And there are no two better boys one could ever hope to have as sons. They're quite wonderful. And I appreciate every day that I have with them based on some of the things I've been through, not only the Afghanistan tour, but there's other things I've done that, which have been not without risk in the past. And I appreciate every wake up I have now with these guys.
I'm glad to hear that, Tony. The book really is fantastic, Operation Darkheart, and it was moving for a variety of reasons. It was also disturbing for a variety of reasons. And of course, just to give our listeners some background of who you are, you were the Army officer who tried to tip off the 9/11 Commission about the intelligence program, Able Danger, that they had Mohammed Atta in their sights a while before 9/11 happened, and they pretty much just let that information drift away, didn't they?
That's right. Well, I'm glad you bring it up, and it's interesting that you should bring it up. There's two. I was just notified by a friend of mine who read General Shelton's book, who was also done by St. Martin's. He actually talks about Able Danger in good terms and talks about the fact, and this is true, that he came up with the idea of Able Danger. And Able Danger for its time was super groundbreaking. This was an effort which was globally targeting Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda being a global threat, no one really knew how to begin with it at the time. Into the Cold War era, everybody was still focused on geographic kind of nation states. This was a new thing to look at. And so we used the then very advanced technique of data mining as a method of trying to define a global adversary. And during this process, four of the 9/11 hijackers, which were in three of the four groups which conducted 9/11 attacks, were identified. Now, let me be very clear on this. We didn't understand the value of what we had. It's not like these guys stood out other than the fact that they were clearly associated with Al-Qaeda. That is to say that they were identified as being part of active cells. Some of those cells being here in the United States. And that was the frightening part of it. The other frightening part of it, which I hope your listeners will appreciate, is that once we identified this, we were prohibited from looking at certain individuals because they were considered quote-unquote U.S. persons. And anyone who studies the law, the U.S. person concept is one which is both protective and obtuse at the same time by the fact that you and I have certain inalienable rights. Other folks who come here are often granted those rights without regard to their background or beliefs. And because of the then Clinton administration's interpretation of the Gorelick memo, the wall memo, the information we had was never properly shared with the FBI, although I tried at least three different times to set up meetings. And again, this is not actually new information. It was actually contained in a book called Horse Soldiers. Doug Stanton did January 2009, where General Lambert, Jeffrey Lambert, who was the chief of the overall Special Operations Command element running Able Danger, admitted that he'd been briefed on Muhammad Atta and that he was the one who made the decision to not share the information with the FBI. So while my book, I think, defines it in clearer terms than any other time in the past, and frankly, David, I wanted the readers to understand exactly what happened in that room with Dr. Philip Zelikow, the staff director of the 9/11 Commission, when I met with him and provided them the information to him. And one other just quick footnote,
sure.
Michael Scheuer and I were on recently on Fox Business with Judge Napolitano. And while Michael and I didn't necessarily agree with some of the facts relating to specific operations, and I think we'll hold that debate for another day, he and I both hold the 9/11 Commission basically responsible for failure to do their job by the fact that both he as the chief of something called Alex Station, which was the covert action element going after bin Laden, and I working Able Danger, were both ignored. Essentially, the information we provided to Dr. Zelikow was never provided to the 9/11 commissioners, and therefore, I still question to this day what the commission was really trying to do. I do not believe it was an honest attempt at fact-finding. I believe there was a narrative that they wanted to tell, and any facts which were inconvenient to that narrative were essentially left out. And I try to illustrate those issues as best I can from my firsthand account in the book as I write the chapters on Able Danger.
The real irony, I think, about all this is that in your book, I noticed many times there were lawyers coming in and in places where you wouldn't think they would be and telling
right.
you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. And the lawyers came in, they shut down Able Danger because of what you said. But the whole irony of it is now that it seems like we're being spied on anytime they want to spy on us.
And this is where I think it's gravely ironic. Yeah, I've been one who railed against the concept and actually testified to this fact in 2006 that I do believe that if information is on you or me on the internet, I don't think there's much expectation of privacy. You know, if I do an article, it's there. If I have a certain series of publicly disclosed things I do or say, you know, a video of me, that's expected to be there. And I don't believe I have any presumption of protection from anything I say as long as I know it's out there. You and I would both agree, I'm sure, that no credit card information or personal data should be out there, and that should clearly not be out there and be extracted. And I do consider that protected. With that said, the government has been apt in the past during the time of Able Danger to overcompensate for saying, well, any information on you a citizen is restricted and we shouldn't be looking at it, which I think is just lunacy. Other companies, for corporate reasons and commercial reasons, look at our data constantly. I mean, that's how we're bombarded with sales pitches all the time now. So with that said, I think that we need to consider what is necessary and proper for the government. One of the other initiatives they've been doing recently is they're trying to say that, well, basically we can tag you, we can put something on your car without any sort of warrant because it's not really wiretapping, it's just tracking you. And I think that's just lunacy. I'm a big believer that the government has to prove a burden as to why they're in a in tracking anyone. But I think once the decision's made with proper oversight, for example, the FISA court, I cannot imagine why anyone would ever want to avoid the FISA court by the fact the FISA court rarely ever says no. It's a stopgap measure required for making sure that you're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And as a senior intelligence officer, I have always sought oversight so that there is no doubt as to my intentions or what I'm trying to do within the operational objectives of that operation. Anyone who attempts to avoid oversight, in my judgment, is up to no good. And there's really no way around that fact.
Absolutely. And of course, you were in the Army, or you still are in the Army, in a reserve
right.
status, is that right?
Still, I'm still in the Army Reserve, that's correct.
Okay. But you were different from what most folks would consider to be a soldier, right? You were a spook, is that the term?
The official categorization is case officer. One of the things that I talk about a little bit in the book is the fact that, you know, I went through the same training as the other case officers. There's one spot in the world, it's called the farm, which is in the book, where all case officers for our side, for the U.S. side, is trained. That's the farm. And so, unfortunately, redacted the actual location, which I think we'll be able to get back in the next edition. As bizarre it is, because you could Google the farm right now, and you and your listeners would figure out exactly where it's at in about 1/5 of a second.
Right.
And with that said, yeah, I'm a case officer, and we follow a bit of a unique career path, and that includes, you know, obviously we have folks in the reserves as well. So the way that this went about for me was that during the time I was a GS, a government employee of Defense Intelligence Agency, I also retained my status as an Army reservist during that entire time, and therefore for, you know, during times of war, obviously, it's more convenient and I think better to deploy it into a combat zone as an active duty member of the Army rather than a civilian member of the Department of Defense for any number of reasons. And that's how I deployed to Afghanistan, as an Army reservist on active duty.
Right. On page 74, you say that your job is to task, collect, recover, and distribute intelligence, then recommend action. So you spend a lot of time reading and writing on the computer, don't you?
I do. As a matter of fact, one of the prime jobs, as you see in some of the later chapters, was if you get to the chapter on our man in Kandahar, my job is to actually not only review, but actually prompt direct action as required to take advantage of what essentially is perishable information, information which will allow you to take some necessary action against an adversary very rapidly, but, you know, would soon become nothing but historic reference material very quickly if you don't take action for it. So that was one of the primary jobs. And frankly, which distinguishes me, not me as an individual, but me in that position from other positions within defense intelligence. Our job, as I saw it, was to do everything necessary to help the field commanders, which were mostly Army, pursue their combat missions. And I don't know if it came through clearly or not, but a lot of folks at defense intelligence just didn't like that mission. They felt that, you know, their job was to be focused on embassies and policy stuff. I felt the opposite. I felt that, you know, if our job is to support the combatant commanders and help them be successful in prosecution of their mission. And that did result in, I've come out of the Army and I have that attitude. But I think some of the conflict inherently came by the fact that Defense Intelligence Agency was created in 1962 as an analytical organization. And for those who understand analysts, they are very meticulous and careful. Operators such as myself, case officers, are much more willing to take on risk. We believe in managing risk, not avoiding risk. And so there's a very big cultural difference between the senior leadership of Defense Intelligence Agency, even now, and some of the folks like me who have to prosecute on-the-ground missions to make hard decisions about how to obtain what the enemy would say is protected information and get that to the right people so they can take appropriate action.
Right. And of course, on page 2, early on in the book, you say, official timidity, bureaucratic foot-dragging, over-analysis. I saw it leading up to the September 11th attacks. I saw it in Afghanistan while I served there, and I still see it today.
I do. Let's talk about two things in the recent press. First, let's talk about Camp Chapman. Leon Panetta announced, I think 2 days ago, the fact that huge mistakes were made because of the CIA's internal bureaucracy relating to vetting of the asset who blew himself up at Camp Chapman, taking 7 operatives and 2 other guards with him in December of last year during the Christmas timeframe. And of course, Leon Panetta is very big in pointing out, as the current director of CIA, that no one will be held accountable. We want to make changes, but we're not going to fire anybody or make changes. Well, let me tell you something, David. This is not the first time CIA, and again, I'm speaking from experience by the fact I'm trained by them. I've been through their training. I've been through the vetting training that they do. And this is not the first time they've had a huge problem with vetting assets. They have too often allowed case officers to make bad calls without holding their feet to the fire to make sure they're doing the right thing to protect themselves and their asset. And let me cite for you the late 80s and early 90s when the CIA had their lunch eaten by the Cuban intelligence service. The Cubans were successful in essentially penetrating all of the CIA operations in Cuba. When they beat the polygraph, they come to understand that the CIA relied pretty much entirely on the polygraph. So if you beat the polygraph, you're in. And it was a real problem with CIA not holding accountable its case officers. They were more worried about scalps and at least the perception of progress rather than real progress. The same thing happened again. So I'm very skeptical that the bureaucracy at CIA, which I'm very heavily critical of in the book as well, will do anything to change its ways. As a matter of fact, I think it's one of those examples of bureaucratic momentum that is just, it's never going to change unless you really take out the senior officers take out and that you fire them or make them retire, you're going to continue to have this culture of bureaucratic nonsense and we'll do whatever the hell we think we want to do and don't worry about oversight. So that's one of the most current examples. Another example, I think, has been clearly demonstrated by the current combat operations. There was, again, 2 days ago, an article in the New York Times talking about crushing the Taliban in Kandahar. Well, I think crushing is a bit of an overstatement by the fact that they're kind of like jello. I think they slipped through the fingers of the ISAF and U.S. forces to fade away into the hinterlands to come back at some other later date, since we've announced we're leaving next summer. So it's very hard to nail jello to the wall. And I think the statement that we've nailed jello to the wall is a, you know, okay, great, you've got the nail in there, but you really didn't do anything to stop the jello from moving away. So we continue to have this almost arrogant attitude about the war. And I think that is driven by this huge bureaucracy, which is more suited to trying to demonstrate and show progress rather than make progress. Because as noted by a lot of folks debating this issue right now, we're only essentially surging in 5 provinces in Afghanistan. The Taliban have made huge gains in the areas we're not. And now that we've announced we're leaving, no matter how the president now couches that by saying, well, we're going to have a conditions-based withdrawal, the Taliban doesn't care. They're using that to their advantage and telling people, obviously, as soon as the Americans leave, we're coming to get you if you cooperate. So those are the two things where I think the bureaucracy, and driven by its interest to self-protect, has almost become a third political party in this country. They have become so powerful, they almost dictate policy to any standing party. In this case, you know, you've got the military-industrial complex essentially committed to this idea of stabilizing the Karzai government. I think not only is it a bridge too far, I think the folly will result in nothing but additional loss of life for no real objective reason and us leaving with no real gains in Afghanistan. And as you may recognize from my book, I'm arguing that the real issue is Pakistan, and that's where we should be really focused on at this point in time.
Absolutely. It's sad. It really is. On page 141, he said, "You mean the insurgency?" I said as the light went on. He said, "That is a very unpopular word." They didn't even want to hear the word insurgency. Right?
No, they did not. It was a very unpopular concept of word, since during that very time, and I think we actually have a quotation of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld quoting from Kabul that, "I don't see any Taliban here." And it's like, no, they're over in Pakistan reorganizing. So yes, it was a very unpopular term, one which we've come to rue the day of talking about, you know, all these years later.
Unbelievable. The book really is so engaging and it reads like a spy novel, although I don't have much time to read fiction nowadays. I want to just read something real quick from page 236, where the chapter is Alpha Team Go, where you say, "Just as I moved toward the door, I heard the command, 'Team Alpha, go.' The SEAL team leader's voice in the helo came in clear over the radio. Over a low but distinctive hum, the speaker chirped a couple of times with static." And on the next page, where someone had run out of the area where the SEALs were attacking, the runner said the SEAL commander in the talk, "Do you have the runner in your sights?" "Yeah, we got him," came back the answer. "We see him. Can you take him out?" A brief pause. "Yeah, he can. He's got a clear shot. Is there any chance a ground team can capture him?" A brief delay. "No, we don't think so. He's got too much of a lead." Everyone looked around the room. "Take him out," said the SEAL commander in the talk. "Roger." 30-second delay. "Okay." I'm not going to say what happened next, but this book is just, it's just exciting. And the beauty of it is, it's a truth and it's real. Is this the first time you've written a book, Tony?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, this is my first time. Wow. And I appreciate your words. Yeah, I kind of send shivers through my spine just hearing it again, believe it or not.
I appreciate everything you did. You're a great man. You are a patriot. You're a hero. You're a real hero. And you didn't have it easy out there. I don't remember the page right now, but you didn't sleep for 2 days. The way you ran those convoys at 100 miles an hour, running away from missiles, small arms fire, IEDs, from kids that you thought might be lobbing bombs at your convoy.
Right.
It was not an easy life. And you did this for one reason, to protect the United States. And the bureaucrats, they just turned their back on you, didn't they?
Well, David, sad as it is, some didn't. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I've often talked about DI in bad terms. There are still good people there, but you're right. There's a number of folks who just really don't care. And it's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that. I appreciate your compliment first. And secondly, I'll cite for you the DOD Inspector General Report of 2006 that comes after me. Basically, they spend about 40% of the report not fact-finding, but trying to find a fault in myself being imperfect. And in that report, they call me, and I think you'll find the irony in this based on that report versus what they did to my book, they call me a marginally qualified intelligence officer. So I've always loved that quote by the fact that now, all these years later, all of a sudden I'm super knowledgeable by the fact that my book would cause grave damage to national security if I come out. So
right.
It's one of those cases where clearly DOD is trying to have it both ways, where clearly I'm incompetent, but we can't let his book go out because there's too much information in there which may hurt the Department of Defense. So it's a grand irony, but I appreciate your thoughts and feelings and your compliment. And I'll say this about that. I and others have signed up to do this job because we felt that protecting the country was the right thing to do. I honestly thought I would die in my 20s during the Cold War. war. My generation coming up, and I think we're similar age, I really thought we would die in Europe. I really thought I would be sent to Europe and die in some conflagration with the Soviets and to fill the gap. So I fully expected to be dead by 30. So it's very interesting now that we've done what we've done, and I think we're obligated to protect the future for our kids. I don't think enough folks really have that attitude. It's kind of like, ah, it's over there, it's not here. And I don't think people understand that even though the 9/11 attacks have been kind of a distant memory now, it could always happen again here, and we're obligated to do everything we can to stop that from happening in the future.
Absolutely. Now you're a senior fellow and director of external communications for the Center for Advanced Defense Studies, where you're the center's spokesman and expert on intelligence gathering operations and transnational terrorist threats. Isn't that right?
That's correct, yes. And I've been there for, well, almost since the center was actually created in some form or another. We pride ourselves in trying to be totally nonpartisan. We are not trying to be a Brookings. We're not trying to be a Heritage. We're trying to be a place. Dylan Radigan over at MSNBC calls us a fact tank, which, you know, the director didn't like in the beginning, but he gets it now. And frankly, I can go on. I think your listeners will figure this out and see it very shortly, because it's going to happen again next week. I will go on Fox News and I will go on MSNBC and I will use the exact same facts on both venues. And I'd like to believe that's the reason we get asked to both venues, is because we really try to focus on the real issues, not on the political issues. And don't get me wrong, we understand the politics that have to be looked at, but we try not to be political in our examination of those issues.
Right. And of course, I highly recommend the book if folks want to go out and get it right on the internet, OperationDarkHeart.com. Is that the best place for them to go, Tony?
Yes, it is. We are also selling autographed copies, which would be great for Christmas if other people want to start Christmas shopping early.
Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, author of Operation Darkheart. Thanks so much, Tony.
Well, thank you, Dave. It was a great interview. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.